Good morning. My name is Jessica Sievers. I will be your convener today on this beautiful November 8th morning. The Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan is rooted in living tradition, embraces diversity in all forms as it expands our thinking and sense of community. I would like to draw your attention to the announcements in your order of service. A couple of things coming up is the UUFM campus lunch Thursday at noon. Contact Molly McGoy. And Happy Kitchen is going to be Friday, November 13th. Our drum circle is also Friday, November 13th. And after the service, you can speak to Shirley, but she's not here. We'll find out where we're going for lunch if you would like to join us after the service. We welcome all of those who are current members, new members, and guests. Today we have Reverend Jill Jarvis from the Unitarian Fellowship of Lawrence and her husband Chris Cox.
Each morning we must hold out the chalice of our being to receive, to carry, and to give back. May we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to the community, and to each other. Were some of you at the Mid-America Conference, the first ever Mid-America Conference held in Topeka a couple of years ago? Right. Well, those of us who were planning the big Sunday worship service, the public worship service, chose this hymn that's going to be our first hymn this morning because we were talking about Unitarian Universalism in the Midwest, and particularly Kansas, and this hymn has imagery of frontiers and prairies and the past leading into the future. So let's rise in body or spirit and sing together hymn number 290, Bring, O Past, Our Honor, Your Honor.
Thank you.
It's time for the story of all ages. If the children would please come forward.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, this is a story for all ages, so everybody, good morning. We have some props this morning, and this is a story and needs to really include everybody. So these props are sort of things that you would use in everyday life to do work, but they have some capability of making some music. So except for these two, I'm going to use those two. The rest, and those of you who are able to sing and carry a tune, I guess, or not, if you could use your voices also for this. So this is a story about when the music kept playing, and it's a story about how we can make things happen all together when we think that maybe they have stopped. So the story is, there was a land called the Warbles. It was the land of the Warbles. And Warbles were little creatures like gnomes, only unlike gnomes that we usually know, they had like fuzzy feathers, like duck feathers, all over them. And because of that, they were called fuzzy warbles. So this was the land of the fuzzy warbles. And they had an amazing talent. Every warble could sing so well, beautifully, and their voices sounded like a combination of clarinets and human voices and bird songs. It was beautiful. In fact, they sang so well, they never learned to talk. So nobody in the land of fuzzy warbles ever spoke a word. They just sang. And it would sound beautiful throughout the land. For example, when they just wanted to say good morning to each other, they sang it. And it sounded like... Yes, it sounded just like that. And sometimes it was just more ordinary things that they would sing to each other, like, take out the trash, please. That sound better than singing? Or don't miss the bus, dear. Yes. So that's how their whole land sounded every day in the land of the fuzzy warbles. And all was going really well until the king died. Well, when the king died, a new king came in, and he, unlike every other warble in history, this king couldn't sing well. His voice was kind of like a frog. And because of that, he had spent his whole life being massively irritated at all the singing around him. But now, for the first time ever, he could do something about it. Because he was the king. So he issued a decree of silence. And he said, there will be no more singing in the land of the fuzzy warble. No more singing. From now on, if people want to communicate, and you must communicate, we will use sticky notes. So just write whatever you want to say on sticky notes and hand them, stick them up, whatever you want there, but use that. But the fuzzy warbles, they had never used sticky notes. All they'd ever been able to do was sing, and singing made them happy. And some of them tried really hard, and some of them didn't try as hard as others, and pretty soon the jail started filling up with disobedient fuzzy warbles. But, you know, they were in jail, and they had nothing to lose then, right? So they just kept singing, and in jails throughout the land, from the jails, echoed these voices of sad but determined fuzzy warbles singing. And the new king,
He stood on his balcony, opened the doors, and listened, and he was like, I issued a decree of silence. What's happening? I can't control this, but maybe if I called in the wizard. So the king called in a wizard, and he said, I want them silenced. I want them not to be able to sing. And so the wizard said, all right. And he took a special magic jar. And the wizard went to the top of the highest mountain in the land of Fuzzy Warbles. And he made a spell as he listened to all the songs. And he waved his wand and he took the top off his special pot. And suddenly the land went silent and this golden mist came floating up toward the mountain and got smaller and smaller and smaller. And then it went right into the vase and he stopped it up. Everybody was quiet and then he gave it to the king, who hid it in a very secret place in his very wealthy-looking bedroom in the palace. And now there were sticky notes everywhere because the warbles, they couldn't sing, and since they couldn't talk, and the land was really sad, and it was really boring. But everybody kept having to work. The king was happy, and nobody else was. One day, a little warble, his name was Curtis. Curtis was just doing his job. He was washing dishes after lunch. And suddenly he started feeling a little happier again. And he started noticing that he was tapping his feet. And it was because a spoon that he had was clicking against a pot that he was washing. And it was making rhythm. It was making music. And so he kind of started dancing around and feeling happy, and other warbles heard it, and they started doing that too. They started making music with just whatever they had, and you started hearing a rhythm going in the land. Like that. Yes. And it got louder and louder, and the warbles got happier and happier. It was great, except for the king. The king went on in his balcony and he listened. Yes, there was music out there. And he wasn't happy. But he saw that everybody else was happy and he didn't get it because they weren't singing. They were quiet, but he heard the music. And then pretty soon, his foot began to tap. And he started feeling kind of upbeat. And he was out on his balcony, and so he started tapping on the balcony. And then there was a suit of armor that was on the balcony. He started tapping against the suit of armor, and that was really loud. And he was just feeling better and better, and I am so not going to demonstrate this, but he started moonwalking across the balcony, just like Michael Jackson. And, wow, it was wonderful. It made him so happy, and he realized what he'd missed. So he went in his bedroom, and he found the jar. He'd had a total change of heart because he knew what made people happy. And he opened up the magic jar, and out came the golden mist, went out across the land, and suddenly all the warbles could sing their songs again. But now, not only could they sing their songs, they could make music too. And you know what? The king, he still had a really bad voice, like a frog. But now he had become the best drummer in the whole land. And the whole land was happy, and not ever did they see another sticky note anywhere. So that's what can happen when people all get together and try to make a change, even when they thought it was hopeless. So let's sing the children now out to their class.
Shine.
Thank you. It is now time for our joys and sorrows. If you have a personal joy or sorrow that you would like to share, please raise your hand and wait for the microphone.
Gene Severs. One of my joys, 21 years and a third in the past, Michaela was indirectly in a hot tub, and 28 minutes later she was born with Big Sis putting her first diaper on.
Anybody else? Oh, Michael.
Well, Michael Oldfather, my sorrow is this. I knew that Michaela was going to turn 21 at midnight, so apparently she's still out there taking advantage of this. So we were planning to sing happy birthday to her, and maybe we could in absentia. How about that? I don't know.
Well, she turned 21.
All right, but how about
midnight.
This? Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday.
I did get confirmation at 9 o'clock this morning that the barn dance she went to kept her out late at night. Well, if there's no more joys and sorrows, we will, those that are spoken and unspoken, we will hold you in our hearts. It's now time for our Helping Hand Sunday. I'd like to introduce two members of the board of the Riley County Humane Society, Doctors Lisa Pullman and Jessica Meekins.
Thank you so much for having us. We're grateful to be here and pleased to be your beneficiary today. And just before we get started, we're going to tell you a little bit about what we do, but we have some newsletters that you can learn more about us outside. So the Riley County Humane Society is an all-volunteer 501c3 organization. It was founded long before I moved here in 1975, and from about 1975 to 2003, it was an educational organization. And then in 2003, the mission changed a lot to more into animal rescue, in the sense that there was a lot more awareness of the numbers of animals being euthanized in shelters. And so now what we really focus a lot of our time on is we take adoptable, really nice pets from euthanasia lists of local or statewide shelters and give them medical care. Spay, neuter them, vaccinate them, microchip them, give them any other medical care they need. They're in foster homes, and then they are adopted out to families that are searching for a pet. Dr. Meekins is going to talk a little bit about one of the cases that we had that wasn't just a routine case, just to give you an idea of some of the things that we do.
One particular case we had last year, almost a year ago to the date, was a little Shih Tzu named Pepper, and she was actually picked up by a Good Samaritan in a neighboring town of Ogden, in pretty rough shape. She had terrible flea infestation and mange and skin infections, as well as she just was suffering from neglect. And she was brought into the vet school actually initially by this Good Samaritan, and then was taken over to T. Russell Wright's animal shelter. From there, we were able to get involved because the city-run shelter doesn't have the resources sometimes that we do to try to help nurse animals with more intensive medical needs back to health. And so I'm very proud to kind of fast forward through the story and let you know that after quite a bit of nursing care, Pepper is doing wonderfully today and found a forever home and is a very happy, healthy girl. And that's just one of a multitude of stories we could share with you this morning, just hours upon hours of rewarding happy endings, or happy tales, as we call them sometimes, of the pets that we've been able to help.
We also provide a fair amount of financial assistance in the community. We have received grants from the city. There's a part of the city organized through the Greater Manhattan Community Foundation. There's a Pine Grant. So we have a one-time emergency fund for people that can't afford, you know, if their animal was, let's say, hit by a car and they can't afford that treatment, but it is a good prognosis, we will help pay for that care. The other grant that we have is specifically for elderly and disabled if they have a pet and they can afford to spay, neuter, vaccinate, so the more preventative care. So we do a lot for pets that are owned in the community as well as rescuing pets that are deserving of finding a forever home that have just need another chance in life. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Renee. And now it's time to have a reading called What We Cannot Do Alone by Margie Allen. Today we have two lovely volunteers, Jane Pelletier and Christopher Renner, to read that to us today.
Morning.
Morning.
I put my hand in yours, so that we might do together what we cannot do alone.
What is it that you cannot do alone?
You can't have a birthday alone. Unless you were born on February 29th, you share your birthday with over 19 million people around the world. It's not yours. You share it.
You can't become yourself alone. You can't, because you are made of the experiences you have and don't have and the people you meet and don't meet. You can be alone, but you can't be you alone. You can contain multitudes, and they can enter the you of you one at a time with gravity and laughter, cleverness, and even sometimes ulterior motives.
You can't make a meal alone. Even if you start with just flour and water and yeast, you already have partners in the farmer and the engineer and the little living things that eat sugar and make gas. Someone made the bowl and the spoon. To get even the simplest ingredients to your table that a tree and a lumberjack and a millwright and a carpenter made for you, you depend upon the help of thousands.
You can't raise a child alone. Heck, you can't even make one yourself. It takes at least one of these and one of those particular tiny cells becoming one together. And then it takes a village, a delivery, and a teacher, and a friend, and a librarian, and the author of a helpful book, and a doctor, and a neighbor, and a pharmacist, and maybe a partner, or a grandmother, or an older sibling. It takes a big village to make a small one.
You can't become part of the 1% alone. You didn't make your fortune all by yourself, even if you tell everyone around you and the world that it was your bootstraps that lassoed all this cash. There is no way the janitor and the ship's captain and the policewoman and the secretary and the president weren't somehow turning things just a little bit in favor of this or that dollar coming your way. You don't get all the credit.
You can't be an artist or a preacher or a writer alone. You need to write or paint or preach about something, and people are an endless font of material. You need their input. You need their need, actually, because you're trying to meet it, or at least tease them about it, without actually discouraging them. They make you a better artist by listening, by looking, by responding, or not.
You can't find the truth alone. You need the scripture and the songs and the stories that other people wrote and sang and told in order to find the truth. Even when you think you have found it, there is always a truer truth, or another truth, or a truth that, believed, makes the world a better place, even if it is not really true. You need other brains to find the truth, and someone to take the mote out of your eye after you take the mote out of theirs. And then there is meaning-making. You could try to make it alone, but there will be a glitch. You do not have eyes to see.
You can't end racism alone or stop and reverse the process of climate change. You can't make a better law, reduce drunk driving, protect the human rights of new immigrants, stop child abuse or hate crimes all by yourself. You need stories, information, advice, leaders, lobbyists, voters, and marchers. You need an outcry and real, very present bodies who see the line between the choice for good and the choice for evil in their own hearts. They need you to help them choose love, to stand with you, to not give up. And you need them back.
You can't create a service like this alone, not in a million years. It takes more than one body to move energy this way, and that is just the bottom line. Somebody has to warm the welcome, harmonize, direct, set up the chairs, make the piano do piano things. But the voices of the ancestors chime in too, and the longing of the children's children's children come through too. You can't do the first thing here by yourself. You are tapping into the web.
You can't be a Unitarian Universalist alone. To be one, you have to make promises and try like mad to keep them. You have to enlist people you trust to help you keep your promises. You have to tell them how you are doing and ask them how they are doing too. You can't even keep your own promises alone. You need partners in that work. And the deeper the promise cuts, the deeper the partnership goes. That's what it means to be accountable. Keeping promises can be painful. You need help, hope, solving, and saving. Your promises plus mine plus theirs make a living faith that survives and serves the ages. People who loved your unborn self were burnt at the stake or spent half their lives in jail or were shunned by their communities, lost everything but their faith, all to make sure this tradition made its way forward in time so that you could join its ranks.
I put my hand in yours so that we might do together what we cannot do alone.
Amen.
Thank you, Jane and Chris. Please stand in body or spirit, and we will sing hymn number 318, We Would Be One. Please welcome Reverend Jill Jarvis from the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Lawrence. Today she asks, what is beloved community and who is included in it? We'll hear about new initiatives for shared resources, interfaith legislative action, and new connections for spiritual deepening.
Thank you, Jessica.
It's been several years since I've been here. It is really good to be back in this beautiful space with you beautiful people. I was at a retreat in early October in Iowa with some other Unitarian Universalists from the Midwest, and we were talking casually at one point about how some really progressive things had happened in our states. Iowa's early legalization of same-sex marriage, Minnesota investing millions into early childhood education and raising taxes on the wealthiest 2%. And people were smiling and high-fiving when a somewhat tentative, lonely voice spoke up. Hey, don't forget Kansas. We did great on abolition. At least we could say that Unitarians from New England were instrumental in establishing missions in Kansas before the Civil War for the purpose of keeping it a free state. And yes, they did great on abolition. They also had the intention of spreading the good news of liberal Christianity here before Orthodoxy could get a foothold. But over the long run, the Kansas Historical Quarterly, published in 1964, reported that Unitarianism in Kansas had failed. It said there was one congregation each in Wichita, Topeka, Manhattan, Lawrence, and Hayes, all very small and all, as they said, curiously located in towns with public institutions of higher learning. But not one dates from territorial days. And by the way, there were also two thriving Universalist churches in Kansas, Hutchinson and Junction City, that were founded in the late 1880s, but both of them also eventually declined into small discussion groups and then just disappeared. And when I spoke about this in Lawrence, one of our members informed me that he thought there might have also been a Universalist church in Lawrence, but we haven't found it yet, if there was. And so maybe that decline is best explained by an article that had just been published in 1963 in the leading Unitarian Universalist magazine. It was just after the merger.
It told of a comment by the Reverend George Marshall, who was the minister of the Church of the Larger Fellowship at that time, which connected isolated UUs by mail. Then it was snail mail. Marshall declared to his parishioner, Albert Schweitzer, that, quote, "our people do not proselytize," unquote. Well, that was a far cry from the attitude of those first Unitarians in Lawrence who were struggling to grow a church with a strong voice for freedom and justice in the new Kansas Territory. They knew they couldn't do that alone. In the mid-1850s, the very Orthodox Congregational minister, Reverend Lum, who was also trying to establish a foothold there, complained bitterly to his denomination about how the Unitarians and others were producing a union of all denominations, quote, upon a basis having no creed and no discipline. Those who ignore Christ's divinity hope to get a controlling influence. Meanwhile, the Unitarian minister, Reverend Newt, was writing glowing accounts of the Interfaith Alliance of Lawrence ministers. A real and hearty union, he wrote, from every denomination, but with a single exception. Not surprisingly, the Reverend Lum, the Congregationalist. Well, for whatever reason, during the century and a half or so since Reverend Newt's time, Unitarian Universalist congregations in Kansas became small and isolated, inward-looking groups with virtually no influence on public policy. And Kansas public policy became, you know. But I'm here today to update you all. That situation is history, at least the first part of that. Just about 10 years ago, as some of you know, Kansas UU congregations, along with All Souls in Kansas City, known together as the Southern Cluster of what was the Prairie Star District, with a group of lay leaders and ministers, decided that we needed to do something to grow Unitarian Universalism and our liberal, life-affirming faith in Kansas. And we knew that not one of our congregations could do that alone. So with some private funding and with some grants from the UUA, we formed the Southern Cluster Outreach and Extension, SCORE, to do that work together. We wanted to be able to call it the SCORE Board because we were that clever. So SCORE hired student ministers, first Megan Conrad, then me, to travel to congregations without ministers to give workshops and preach, meet with the boards, and help them do outreach in their communities. SCORE brought representatives from all our congregations together regularly to learn from each other and to plot strategy. And SCORE stopped being active in that way about 5 years ago, but by then we'd made a lot of progress already. The Unitarian Fellowship of Lawrence had called their first minister. That would be me. It had grown in membership and had built a new sanctuary. UUFT in Topeka had also grown and built a new religious education wing. UUFM had grown and you'd increased your minister's time. Relationships had been established among all our churches. A tiny emerging UU group in Hutchinson had started, and our culture of isolation and inward focus had already changed a lot. Now in 2015, the UUs in Hutchinson have just bought their own building. They're working with contract ministers. They're visibly involved in their community. Check out their website if you get a chance. Salina is thriving. UUUs in Manhattan continue to grow, and in an incredibly exciting move, just brought in Reverend John Alou as a full-time developmental minister to help you achieve your goals for the future, and they're important goals. I've just heard there's a small group in Emporia hoping to establish some UU connection there, and I can't wait to tell you what's happening in Topeka and in Wichita. It's going to make a difference for all of us, and we hope for Kansas. Now, a few weeks ago, I know some of you were present for the annual Southern Cluster retreat in Council Grove, right? Is anybody there? Here? Yeah. Okay, a few weeks, and UUs from across the state were gathered there to build relationships, to play, to learn, to relax together. I helped lead two workshops. The first one was on the spiritual part of congregational social justice work. But we didn't just talk about it. We demonstrated it. We did it together for 1 hour. It looked like this. We got settled. We reviewed the basics of deep listening. No questions or conversation when someone's talking. Listen to their voice tones, note their body language, their emotions. Try to feel where the speaker is coming from as they share their experiences. And then I asked everyone to just sit together in silence for a few minutes. And I asked this. Remember a time in your life when you felt compelled to respond to an instance of injustice, large or small, personal or societal, but when you felt compelled, and for whatever reason, you did not or you could not respond. Try to remember how that felt as we sit in silence together. And then if you feel moved to do so, speak aloud a word or phrase about that. The words came into that silence. Discouraging, frustrating, angry, disappointing, powerless. Then a few people shared those stories while the rest of us deeply listened. And next I said, let's sit in silence again and think about another time when you felt compelled to respond to an injustice. And you did respond. Remember how that felt. And some of the words that came from those memories were fulfilled, powerful, conflicted, hopeful, connected. And we listened to some of those stories too. I'm wondering, as I'm saying this, whether some of you might be thinking right now about your own stories and remembering some of your own feelings connected to them. And at the end, we talked about the absolute necessity of having a community of trusted people who will listen to you and who will be vulnerable enough to share their own stories about this very difficult work that we do together. Because our expectations as individuals are very different, even around a given issue. During that hour we just spent together, we'd held the memory of shared hopes and feelings of empathy and guilt and powerlessness. It's not possible to transform the world without transforming ourselves. It's not a step we can just skip over without burning out. This is work we cannot do alone. So that spiritual deepening piece was foundational to the second workshop when we talked about organizing and collaboration. Reverend Sarah Oglesby Dunnigan from Topeka started by telling us about her previous experience in the UU Mountain Desert District in Colorado, where our churches have done some amazing work in collaboration with each other and with the interfaith community. How, Sarah asked, how can we bring that passion here to Kansas? How will we show up for each other? Can we be a group of people who can count on each other to caravan across the state and show up when another UU church needs us in their community? She noted that our I-70 choir had showed up in Topeka to sing at her ordination and installation the year before last, which she took as a very good sign, and indeed it is. So first we told everybody at the workshop about the upcoming pulpit exchanges. This one, for example. Last spring, Reverend Sarah, Reverend David Carter from Wichita, and I had conspired to find ways to lead our congregations into a greater collaboration. So we decided to do two rounds of pulpit exchanges, one in the fall, one in the spring, each guest preaching in the other's congregations. Then Reverend John Alou arrived in Manhattan and asked for UUFM also to be included. So now we have four. And not only will this start to build deeper relations, but it will free up considerable sermon writing time for each of us to be more deeply involved in outreach in our communities and doing this Justed Center work, which is time-consuming. As you know, the first round started last week. We have this overarching theme of the fall pulpit exchanges of building the beloved community. What does that mean, beloved community? A term used by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and now very familiar to UUs. We're all speaking to different aspects of that. And here's the very exciting news coming out of Topeka, the formation of the Kansas Interfaith Action. And here's the backstory. A lot of us in Lawrence have been very, very saddened by the fact that Ecumenical Campus Ministries at KU, which has been an incredible force for liberal religion and social justice in the Lawrence community, has fallen on hard times, and they've hopefully temporarily lost their 501(c)(3) status. Well, another organization which you might know, Kansas Interfaith Power and Light, which focuses on environmental justice, they didn't have their own 501(c)(3) status, so they were using the ECMs. So Kansas IPL had a problem for a brief moment in time. But now they've regrouped. They have their own 501(c)(3) as Kansas Interfaith Action, still led by Rabbi Modi Reber, now based in the Kansas capital. Our own Reverend Sarah in Topeka is on the board. I don't know yet whether they're calling it KIFA or KIFA. We were calling it KIA until it was pointed out to the rabbi that that means killed in action and was not a good thing to call it. So we're sticking the F in there, interfaith. I'll call it KIFA here. It will take up a range of issues that affect Kansas: race, income, education, climate change, and others. And the hope is that this will become a visible, dynamic, respected interfaith group similar to Moral Mondays in North Carolina, if you're familiar with that. So that first question is, how do we begin to build our capacity to work with each other? As for Unitarian Universalists, all the ministers, along with other clergy, will be part of a clergy advisory board, which is going to start momentarily, to decide which issues KIFA will take up. It could be Medicaid expansion, Black Lives Matters, ecological justice. What else? We'll see. And the Kansas City metro area has a growing, very racially diverse interfaith group, and Rabbi Modi is working to get them to also be part of KIFA, working with us in Topeka. So do you see the potential this all has for progressive values in Kansas? For Unitarian Universalism in Kansas? I think that by spring, you'll see some major progress with this. I had breakfast yesterday morning with some friends of mine and an old friend that I hadn't seen for a while, who is a lawyer in a small town in Kansas. He might be the only liberal within hundreds of miles of where he is. But on Facebook, he is very, very active in promoting social justice issues. And he's very familiar with all the issues, and he can articulate them very well. And he's quite comfortable hosting discussions of all his not-so-liberal friends in the area he lives in Kansas, who really take him on about all of these. And he is very, as I said, outspoken and unintimidated. So at breakfast, I was telling him about this because I wanted him to know. So I said, Max, listen, we're working on something really important and I think that you'll be really interested in. And I first told him about Moral Mondays in North Carolina, how this very racially diverse group interfaith group. People gathered on Mondays on the Capitol steps and held worship services and did prophetic witness. And he's frowning at me. He's looking puzzled, and he's frowning at me. So I just went on and said, "And this is happening in Kansas. We're going to do this and this and this, and we hope that this will happen by the springtime." And now he's really frowning at me and is silent. I said, "What?" And he said, so all these fundamentalists are going to be doing this?" I'm like, "Max, no! Why would you even think that? I mean, I'm telling you about this. I'm excited, you know?" And then I realized, even though he is a very strong social justice advocate and well-connected, all I had to do was say people of faith, and he thinks fundamentalism, right? And it just struck me how much in Kansas we may be talking, we people of faith who are liberal, active in social justice issues, are talking to ourselves, and how much it's important that we get out there and say the religious voice is not the voice of the far right. That is not the only religious voice, and we are not going to be silent anymore. I want to tell you the story of a young man who some of you know, I think, from the Wichita UU Church. His name is Louis Goslin, and he's a very experienced professional community organizer. So he was at the workshop in Council Grove. He told us that a few years ago that church was looking to deepen its social justice work in the community, and they held some sort of big event. Louis said he'd never really been to a church willingly. But when First UU in Wichita had reached out to Sunflower Community Action to offer financial help and had said, "We'd like to get our members and our minister more involved in your work," in that connection, Louis showed up at the church, and he saw all these other activists that he knew from his other community work, and also people of a lot of different faith backgrounds. Then they all went to Washington together to do some direct action, and Louis got to know Reverend David Carter from Wichita, who I think was here last week. Mm-hmm. And seeing the minister so visibly involved in justice work, Louis decided he could step into that church, and he did. He said he'd had a background of feeling powerless and fearful, and he found that through action with others, he could feel empowered and not alone. It was unexpected, but it was good, he said, to find a religious home. And because of Louis being there, First UU has started bringing in more young people and more people of color and from other marginalized groups. So here's some exciting UU Kansas news, which some of you, again, already may have heard. With 114 members, but with a grant from the UUA, First UU in Wichita has created a new staff position. They'd been working with a consultant to get more active and public as a church, and they've just hired a social justice coordinator. You might think that that's all about organizing around issues and getting its members involved. But in fact, that's only part of this new coordinator's position. Because the other part, the really primary part, is about helping the congregation do that internal work. The members asking themselves and each other those foundational and those difficult questions. How do we feel powerless? How are we complicit in systemic injustice? How do we benefit from it? How can we feel more connected to people who are oppressed? This is how that church will be investing its time and energy to start with, and not, as Louis put it, not just acting on their anger. He told us a story about what can happen when we don't do this transitional work, transformational work, rather. So about the time that the church was hosting a meeting in their sanctuary about immigration, they had invited a lot of Latinos and Latinas there with the idea to all work together for compassionate immigration reform. And the UUs were quite pleased about how that meeting turned out. But a lot of the Latinos, not so much, it turned out from the feedback. For one thing, some of the white UUs had cluelessly and repeatedly used the term illegal immigrant. And they'd said reports of their mooching off of the economy were just not true. Illegal immigrants were hardworking people who benefited the economy. And they couldn't even hear the impact of those words on the Latinos and Latinas, that people are only to be valued and accepted if they work hard and benefit the economy. And that created a tension, Lewis said, but it turned out to be a creative tension because they didn't run from it. When we invite people into our space, we better know what it is that we bring to that space. But how do we get people to act and to stay involved? How can a whole congregation feel called and not powerless or apathetic? I'm sure you know that's a question that frustrates a lot of UU social justice activists. Reverend Carter said, "What rescues us from our complacency can only be that we realize the urgency. While so many are struggling, while so many are dying, the relatively privileged can dip into and back out of these difficult conversations as they have the time and the interest and the energy. We don't feel the urgency. We don't have to." And when he said that, I remembered one huge aha moment for me. It was on the one-month anniversary of the killing of Trayvon Martin, the young unarmed black man in Florida. I attended a vigil and a rally in Kansas City, and it was a public outcry against the fear and the violence that affects the black community, especially young men. It was very well organized, very heavily planned, and it had been promoted throughout the city, in the newspaper, on television, on all the news websites. It was Twittered. It was on Facebook. The press was there. The mayor spoke. A city councilman spoke. Religious leaders spoke from this big platform in the middle of the park. And there were so many people. There's so many people. For 3 hours on that late March Monday afternoon, they kept coming until there were nearly 800 people there, right in the middle of the very predominantly white Country Club Plaza. I kept looking around. Easily 90% of that crowd was black. You know, where was the white community? Where were the traditional beneficiaries of the system that fosters violence against young black men? Where were the liberal white community activists? The speakers all deliberately focused on staying very positive. It was obviously very carefully orchestrated, but in a moment of inattention by those leaders, one man climbed up on the stage, grabbed the mic, looked out over the crowd and said, "Look around you. Where are all the white people? They're not here because it's not their kids being killed." And then he was hustled off that stage. The next day, the mainstream press reported the size of the crowd, not one word about the racial makeup. I know there were lots of white people who were probably there in spirit, but they didn't take the trouble to show up. Because it's not about intention or goodwill, it's about awareness of what's going on outside the bubble of our own lives, or even our own pain. The black community felt the urgency. It was their kids being killed, and it's still their kids being killed. Only when all of us can feel that energy, because we've listened and heard and know that they are our kids, will we feel that call. And will we respond? That's why that inner work in community and trusted community is so crucial. When Reverend Sarah from Topeka worked with the Interfaith Group in Colorado, they'd been visible and active in support of a group of dreamer kids, mostly teenagers who were born in America but who faced deportation because they'd been brought illegally to this country as very young children. And she told us about the time when they all came together at the Capitol when one of their dreamer teenagers had just committed suicide. The group, including many UUs, came together to mourn, to support the other dreamer kids, and to witness in a very visible way. They created a three-tier circle, a prayer circle, the students all in the center, the clergy of different faiths in the middle circle, and outside a tier of community leaders. And they all had their hands on each other's shoulders. And one at a time, they took turns praying aloud, each in the words of their own tradition, for justice, for reconciliation, for mercy, for love. There were tears and sorrow, determination and hope, and one of those UUs told Sarah, "You know, if you'd asked me 9 months ago before I started this work to come to a prayer event, I'd have said, why? What good will that do?" But this was probably the single most amazing and inspirational experience of my entire life. Suddenly, I get it. I get it. It's only together that we can ever get it. That's the source of the grounding that will let us answer the call that comes from deep within and that calls from the voices of people without affordable health care or housing, people in communities stricken by violence from both within and without, women without access to reproductive health care, transgender people bullied and rejected, victims of gun violence. Together in small groups, in our congregations, as Kansas UUs with other people of faith, that's how we finally act, because we get it. May it be so. Let's rise now in body or spirit to sing our closing hymn in the Teal Hymn Book, Building a New Way, 1017.
We've only sung this once, I think, a long time ago. The trick is, remember, right words at the right time on the right note. One or two out of three is better than none. And what will happen is, the introduction is six beats. One, two, three, four, one, two, sing. And then, but then when you change verses, you just get two beats, and then you got to go on to the second, third, and verse, okay? All right. We're ready? Okay.
Is too beautiful to be praised by only one voice. May you have the courage to sing your part. The world is too broken to be healed by only one set of hands. May you have the courage to use your gifts. Go in peace.